Staying truly informed today, it feels like a constant uphill battle, doesn't it? The news cycle just never stops.
It really doesn't.
That's why we created the Deep Dive, to help you cut through the noise and really get what's going on.
Think of this as your smart shortcut to the information that matters. We take a close look at key stories, drawing insights from various sources to give you a clear and efficient understanding.
Exactly. And today we're diving into a recent PBS NewsHour episode. It touched on quite a range: health, legal stuff, economic shifts, international
A
relations.
real mix.
Yeah. So our goal for you in this deep dive is pretty simple. We want you to leave with a solid grasp of the big developments and, what they might mean, all without feeling totally overwhelmed by endless details.
Sounds good. So where should we start unpacking this?
Let's begin with that significant piece of health news. Former President Biden recently disclosed he's been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer.
Yes, that news came out, and he followed up with a social media post, mentioned it spread to his bones, which sounds serious.
It does. But he also shared a really moving sentiment, didn't he? Said something like, "Cancer touches us all. Jill and I have learned that we are strongest in the broken places. Thank you for lifting us up." It was quite powerful.
Yeah, really resonated. To get a clearer picture, the NewsHour spoke with Dr. Jay Rollman, chair of urology at Penn State Health.
Okay.
And his explanation of what aggressive means in this context was very helpful.
Right. He clarified it means the cancer is growing faster, basically, and more likely to spread beyond the prostate itself. So places like lymph nodes, liver, and as in Mr. Biden's case, the bones.
But here's a crucial point he made. Despite being aggressive and having spread, prostate cancer is generally one of the more treatable cancers, even at stage four.
That's actually quite hopeful news, isn't it? Especially considering Mr. Biden is 82.
It is. Dr. Rollman stressed there are numerous treatment avenues available. He specifically noted that Mr. Biden's cancer seems to be hormone sensitive.
Okay, hormone sensitive. What does that mean practically for treatment?
Well, basically, these prostate cancer cells need hormones like testosterone, androgens, to grow. So hormone therapy tries to lower those hormone levels.
Ah, cutting off the fuel supply.
Exactly. For the cancer cells, even the ones that have spread. And Dr. Rollman highlighted that there's been considerable progress in drug therapies over the last decade that target this hormonal pathway specifically.
Now, a question a lot of people probably have, and the NewsHour touched on this, is why the diagnosis came relatively late. I mean, considering his access to top-notch medical care.
Right, and this brings up the screening guidelines. Dr. Rollman explained the American Urological Association generally recommends screening for men between 45 and 70.
Only up to 70.
Typically, yes. Routine screening isn't usually advised for men over 70, partly because other health issues might become more pressing, or the potential harms of screening might outweigh the benefits in that age group.
So it might not be neglect, but more following standard medical advice for his age.
That seems to be a key point Dr. Rollman was making. He also mentioned that back in 2014, there was a shift away from doing routine PSA tests quite so often, which might also play a role. Fewer tests overall.
Interesting. So for men listening now, what's the main takeaway for their own health?
Dr. Rollman really emphasized being proactive. He recommends getting an initial PSA blood test, that's the main screening tool, sometime between 45 and 50,
Okay.
and then getting checked maybe every 2 to 4 years after that. The key is early detection makes it highly treatable.
Right. And are there specific groups who should be, extra vigilant or start earlier?
Yes, definitely. Certain factors increase the risk. Being of Black or African ancestry is one. Also, having specific genetic mutations, a family history of prostate cancer, or being of Ashkenazi Jewish descent.
Okay.
For those higher risk groups, Dr. Rollman suggests starting that initial PSA testing earlier, maybe between 40 and 45.
That's really vital information. Okay, turning to some legal and political news now. The NewsHour reported on a Supreme Court order that affects Venezuelan immigrants.
Yeah, this is significant.
Okay.
The Supreme Court basically allowed the Trump administration to go ahead with stripping legal protections, temporary protected status,
Right.
or TPS from hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans.
Hundreds of thousands.
About 350,000,
Yeah.
potentially at risk of deportation now because of this. TPS is, for people from countries facing crises that make it unsafe to return.
That's a huge number facing uncertainty. And there was another ruling involving a government agency.
Yes, a lower court ruling concerning the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Right.
That ruling actually prevented the Trump administration from dismantling the Institute. It's been around for 40 years, created by Congress for conflict resolution.
So a block on dismantling it, but maybe not the final word.
Exactly. The administration can still appeal that decision. So yeah. TBD on that one.
Okay. Shifting now to the international stage, updates on Russia and Ukraine. President Trump made a pretty bold claim about ceasefire talks, didn't he?
He did. He stated he believed ceasefire negotiations would start immediately. This was after he apparently spoke separately with both Putin and Zelensky. He even called his conversation with Putin excellent.
But as we've seen so many times in this conflict, the reality on the ground and the stated positions are usually more complex.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, while both leaders have sort of indicated openness to talks, their conditions seem pretty far apart, still very firm.
What are those conditions, roughly?
Well, Russia's position, according to the report, is focused on eliminating the root causes of the crisis. And they explicitly said no withdrawal from territories they now consider their own, no ultimatums, no giving away land or people. Pretty hard line.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And Ukraine's stance.
Zelensky, while saying he's ready for discussions, also repeated that Ukraine's conditions remain. He did mention possibly considering a high-level meeting, maybe involving the U.S. and others, especially since those direct talks in Turkey ended so quickly, like after just 2 hours.
Right. Not much progress there. Okay, let's turn to economic news. This always hits close to home. Moody's downgraded the U.S. credit rating. That sounds pretty concerning.
It certainly raises eyebrows, yeah. Moody's pointed to concerns about the big annual budget deficits, the growing national debt, and importantly, the rising costs of interest on that debt.
It's interesting, though, the stock market seemed to kind of shrug it off initially.
Yeah, the immediate stock market reaction was a bit muted, but there were other ripples, weren't there?
Like what?
Well, the value of the U.S. dollar dipped, and you could see some pressure in the bond markets. For more insight on this, the NewsHour brought in David Wessel from the Hutchins Center at Brookings.
Okay, and what was his main take on the significance of this downgrade?
He basically said Moody's action just underlines what many already know. The U.S. is on a budget path that isn't sustainable long term. He also pointed out, you know, Moody's isn't the first. They're now the third major agency to downgrade the U.S. rating.
Right. Not unprecedented, then. Did he connect the market reactions, like the dollar dipping and bond market pressure, to anything specific happening now?
He did, yeah. Wessel linked those reactions, especially rising bond yields, which, remember, influenced lots of other interest rates, and the weaker dollar, partly to worries about that big tax bill moving through Congress.
The one expected to add trillions to the debt.
Exactly. Estimates are like $2.5 to $3.5 trillion over 10 years. Plus, he mentioned ongoing uncertainty about tariffs as another factor weighing on things.
So the bigger picture worry is about how global investors see the U.S.
That's the concern Wessel raised. It could chip away at the view of the U.S. as this super stable economic anchor. Less confidence could mean less investment in U.S. securities down the road.
But he wasn't saying, like, immediate default risk.
No, no, not default risk. More like a warning signal that could lead to higher borrowing costs for the U.S. government and ultimately for everyone over time.
It's interesting because previous downgrades didn't always cause this massive flight of investors. Is there something different this time?
That's the key question, isn't it? Wessel noted that while past downgrades didn't trigger panic, the sheer size of the U.S. debt now is much larger. And he also floated the idea that maybe, just maybe, other places are starting to look like viable alternatives for investment.
Like where?
He specifically mentioned the European bond market. If that becomes seen as a genuine alternative to the dollar, that's a different dynamic, more competition.
Okay, so how does all this, you know, potentially trickle down to the average person, the consumer?
Primarily through higher borrowing costs, Wessel explained it simply. When the bond market gets nervous about the U.S. economy and its debt, interest rates on U.S. Treasury bonds tend to go up.
And those Treasury rates are like a benchmark.
Exactly. They influence rates for mortgages, car loans, credit cards. So even small increases there can ripple out and make borrowing more expensive for everybody. It's a long-term worry about financial stability potentially hitting our wallets.
Okay, let's switch gears again. Tariffs on Chinese products, this keeps coming up. And the NewsHour had a really interesting segment on how it might affect, well, everyday stuff.
Yeah, economics correspondent Paul Solomon reported on this. He pointed out a pretty stark fact. Nearly one out of every three physical products made anywhere in the world actually comes from China. That's a huge chunk of the things we buy and use.
And they illustrated this really effectively, didn't they, by having economist Dan Bergstresser basically inventory Paul Solomon's own house.
Exactly. It made it so tangible. They looked at ordinary stuff, a scooper, mugs, toaster, blender, mixer. even the camera lights they were using for the shoot.
And most were made in China.
The vast majority, yeah. It really showed how pervasive these goods are in our homes.
So the obvious concern is that tariffs could make all this stuff more expensive, or maybe even harder to find.
That's the worry. Bergstresser said consumers might be in for some surprises.
Yeah.
As these trade disruptions kind of ripple through the supply chains.
Right.
And he made another key point. Even stuff not directly made in China often has Chinese parts inside. He used the example of an air conditioning compressor assembled here, maybe, but full of foreign, potentially Chinese components.
There was also that mention of potentially bare shelves, maybe fewer toys, echoing some earlier comments from the president.
Yes, that possibility was raised. But Bergstresser also brought in the economic angle of consumer choice. Like, if people want 15 different kinds of mugs, well, that's a demand the economy tries to meet.
Which led to the question, why can't more of this stuff just be made in the U.S.?
And the answer seemed to circle back to uncertainty. Especially uncertainty caused by, you know, trade policy that keeps shifting.
Makes sense. Businesses are hesitant to build expensive factories if the rules might change overnight.
Precisely. It takes huge investment to build factories, and you need some predictability to make that gamble. Constantly changing trade policy creates risk that scares off investment.
The report did give some real-world examples of costs going up, though, right? Like that back deck renovation.
Yeah, the crew working on Paul Salmon's deck said costs were up maybe 20%. A contractor confirmed general price hikes, seeing supplier emails talking about 10% to 30% increases.
And even some specific items at Home Depot.
Right? Things like some European windows had apparently doubled in price. Pricey stuff showing bigger jumps.
But then it got a bit contradictory, didn't it? Because they also found no, like, widespread shortages at Home Depot. And a worker even said they had plenty of stock piled up.
That's right. And consumers they spoke to there didn't seem to notice huge price jumps on most everyday things, maybe just a little more expensive here and there.
So why the discrepancy? Why no crisis yet?
Well, the theory presented was twofold. First, businesses likely anticipated the tariffs and stockpiled goods beforehand.
Ah, building up inventory.
Exactly. And why? Second, the fact that there's currently a pause on some new tariffs might mean there's just enough inventory in the system right now to meet demand.
So maybe the calm before potential storm, the underlying issue of uncertainty is still there.
That's what Bergstresser really stressed. The biggest problem isn't necessarily the tariffs themselves right now, but the lack of predictability and, frankly, credibility around the administration's trade policy. That's what can freeze investment.
And Walmart seemed to echo that concern.
Yeah, underscoring that uncertainty, Walmart announced they might have to raise prices on imported goods pretty soon, like within the month,
right,
because of these ongoing trade policy worries.
Okay, let's move to another area where federal policy changes are having a big impact. The cuts to AmeriCorps. The NewsHour covered the legal fight against these cuts.
Yes, a significant number of states, 24 plus D.C., have actually filed lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's really deep cuts to AmeriCorps funding.
How deep are we talking?
Nearly $400 million slashed from active grants. The expected fallout is pretty stark. Over 1,000 programs shutting down, more than 32,000 jobs likely eliminated nationwide.
Wow. And the report really brought this down to the ground level, showing the impact on local communities through specific nonprofits.
They did. It was powerful. They featured four organizations. Akila Webster from the Indianapolis Neighborhood Resource Center talked about their contract being abruptly terminated.
Right, impacting childcare deserts, speech programs.
Exactly, hitting vulnerable people. Then Paula Fimbo from Spire After School Learning in Virginia, they lost half their funding for this great apprenticeship program for young leaders. A third of their students might be left behind.
And it affects health, too.
Yeah, Mary Dunn Stewart from Greater Richmond Fit for Kids explained how cuts hurt their health prevention work with kids and families, which, you know, could mean a higher cost down the line.
And the fourth one?
Deborah Mann from the Emanuel Family and Child Development Center in Kansas City. She just conveyed this deep uncertainty, highlighting how much they rely on federal funds in a community without many other resources.
So the common theme is just massive disruption and this struggle to replace the federal money, especially in places that don't have a lot of local philanthropy.
That's exactly it. Private donations often can't fill such big gaps, particularly in underserved areas.
Was there any update on the legal challenge itself?
Lisa Desjardins reported a court hearing happened, but no ruling yet on whether the cuts might be temporarily stopped. So in the meantime, programs are shutting down, staff are being laid off, It's happening now, even while they're ironically being asked to apply for next year's funding. Complete uncertainty.
And it wasn't just AmeriCorps getting cut, right? Other nonprofit funding streams were mentioned.
That's right. Cuts to FEMA programs focused on community resilience and USDA programs that help get local food into schools and food banks.
There was that striking example from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, a food bank there had $100,000 worth of fresh food orders just canceled. Suddenly, gone.
When you add all these different cuts together, the total impact must be significant for some communities.
The report suggested it could be like a $2 million swing per year in funding lost for some areas. And that hits basic needs: housing support, childcare, access to food.
Of course, there are always differing views on whether the federal government should be funding these things so heavily.
Right. The report acknowledged the conservative viewpoint that this isn't really the federal government's role and private philanthropy should step up.
But the reality on the ground seems different sometimes.
Well, the experience of these nonprofits suggests philanthropy often isn't enough, especially everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's also the argument from some conservatives that federal support had maybe gotten inflated and communities need to be more self-reliant. Different philosophies at play.
Okay, finally, let's wrap up with the political analysis segment from the NewsHour. They touched on President Biden's health again and also the progress or lack thereof on the president's tax bill.
Yeah, the conversation around President Biden's cancer diagnosis naturally brought those questions about his overall health back into focus, especially with that new book out and the special counsel interview audio being released. Amy Walter from Cook Political Report and Tamar Keith from NPR weighed in.
Did they feel this news fundamentally changed the political conversation?
Tamar Keith kind of suggested that concerns about Biden's age and health weren't exactly new, you know, they've been part of the discussion for a while.
Right.
But she did note this might now also shine a brighter spotlight on President Trump's health, too, given they're both the oldest individuals to run for or hold the office.
Amy Walter brought up an interesting point about Democratic voters, didn't she? About their earlier concerns regarding Biden's age.
She did. She suggested that some Democrats might have felt the party establishment maybe didn't fully address those age concerns earlier when deciding on the nominee.
And that could have implications looking ahead.
Yeah, she thought potential 2028 Democratic candidates might need to sort of acknowledge that history and really project courage and authenticity to connect with voters who felt overlooked.
And how did Republicans react to the health news? Predictably.
Pretty much. Some, like Donald Trump Jr. and President Trump himself, made claims without evidence about a cover-up and questioned Biden's mental state. Though, as Tam Keith pointed out, presidents hiding health issues isn't exactly unheard of historically.
Okay, shifting to the tax bill. It advanced in the House after initially failing. What's the dynamic there?
Right, it got through. Apparently, some Republicans who initially wanted deeper spending cuts decided to vote for it anyway.
Why the change of heart?
Amy Walter's analysis was that basically with such a slim Republican majority, the fiscal hawks kind of have to compromise. They have to support something, even if it's not as conservative as they'd like.
And the moderates might not love the cuts either.
Exactly. There are probably reservations on both sides. But the pressure to just pass something, to get a win, is huge. Walter called it maybe the one legislative train leaving the station for Republicans to show accomplishment.
And President Trump is getting involved directly.
Reportedly planning a trip to Capitol Hill to rally the House Republicans, push for unity, get this bill across the line. He's often seen as the ultimate closer who can really twist arms and get those votes when needed.
But passing the House isn't the end of the story, is it?
Not at all. It goes to the Senate next, where it'll almost certainly be changed. Then those changes have to go back to the House for another vote.
And Walter mentioned something about these big bills in election years.
Yeah, she noted that historically, major legislation like this often becomes kind of an anvil in the following midterm elections, meaning it doesn't always deliver the political boost the party hopes for. Sometimes it can even backfire.
Okay, so bringing this all together after our deep dive today, we've covered quite a spectrum. Started with the complexities around former President Biden's cancer diagnosis and what that means in light of, you know, screening guidelines.
Right. Then we looked at the potential fallout for Venezuelan immigrants losing TPS, the stalled Russia-Ukraine talks, and those economic warning signs. the credit downgrade, the tariff uncertainties.
And importantly, the very real consequences of those AmeriCorps cuts, highlighting the challenges facing nonprofits and the communities they serve. It really shows how these different news threads, political decisions, economic shifts are all kind of tangled together, impacting real lives.
It absolutely does. Which leads us to a final thought for you, the listener, to maybe mull over. Considering this web of political and economic events we've discussed, what single factor do you think might have the biggest long-term impact on your life or on your community? And maybe, why do you think that? Something to keep exploring.
Definitely food for thought. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.